The time here in WRFG is just 4 minutes past 6 o'clock, and we're delighted to welcome back to the studio our good friend Professor Jim Flannery from Emory University. He's here to talk to us about the late, great Seamus Heaney.
Well, as I think most people listening would know, Seamus died in the wee hours of the morning last Friday. And on Saturday morning, I'm sitting here with something that I think is unprecedented. And that is a front cover of the Saturday morning's New York Times, about half of it taken up, with an incredible photograph of Seamus, this beautiful leonine face, and set in a thoughtful pose, and at the same time a rough face, a face that really never left its roots in Moss Bawn, a little townland, really, in West Derry. The entire back cover of the New York Times was devoted, again, to an obituary, and not only that, but on the op-ed page there was a little memoir of him by somebody who knew him, and then on the arts page, yet another statement evaluating his pure poetry. Unprecedented, really, for any man of letters. I mean, with all the things could be covered that day.
So it certainly puts them up on the world stage with the greats.
Utterly. It's a huge tribute. And even as I try to talk about it, it's still a tremendous sadness felled like a great oak tree felled in a forest, something that you've loved. And that really is a force of nature. And yet the most unpretentious, unprepossessing human being, a self-deprecating humor. I remember at a pub once in Sligo being taken out with Seamus and Ron Shuhart, my colleague at Emory, and deliberately with his wife ragging at him. He sits in the corner of, he sits in front of a fireplace, gigantic fireplace there that covered the entire wall, and he sits deliberately on a little stool. And he was, of course, a huge man, and he pulled his cloth cap down over his eyes, and he was basically doing a parody himself of who he was as a country boy. And she comes, ah, come on, Seamus, will you stop it? Will you get away from it? And that was utterly part of him. He just didn't take himself. He took himself utterly seriously as a vessel for great art. But as a human being, he was as natural as any neighbor you'd wish to have.
And, of course, we were very fortunate in the Emory and Atlanta area to have him visit and read for us over an extended period, going back a quarter of a century.
Going back a quarter of a century, I was privileged, actually. I couldn't describe him as a friend. One of the aspects of the man was how he responded to requests and how he did unasked for acts of kindness constantly. You know, he was inundated with requests for help with this, that, and the other thing. And he once said that he was cursed with a modest sense of decency that made him just naturally as a human being respond, because you didn't want to hurt people.
So you have a particular poem of his that you'd like to focus on?
I would love to read a poem that is a favorite of mine. You know, I think, John, I read this actually on this show in 1995 when he won the Nobel Prize, and it's a poem called Follower. It's from his first volume, the volume in 1966 that really catapulted him into world fame as a poet. And it's a poem about his father, and well, let me just read it, and if I may, and then maybe talk a wee bit about why it is, I think, such a powerful and meaningful poem. Follower. My father worked with a horse plow. His shoulders globed like a full sail, strung between the shafts and the furrow the horses strained at his clicking tongue. An expert. He would set the wing and fit the bright steel-pointed sock. The sod rolled over without breaking. At the head rig, with a single pluck of reins, the sweating team turned round and back into the land. His eye narrowed and angled at the ground, mapping the furrow exactly. I stumbled in his hobnailed wake, fell sometimes on the polished sod. Sometimes he rode me on his back, dipping and rising to his plod. I wanted to grow up and plow, to close one eye, stiffen my arm. All I ever did was follow in his broad shadow round the farm. I was a nuisance, tripping, falling, yapping always. But today, it is my father who keeps stumbling behind me and will not go away. And as I read that, I'm conscious of the fact that now it is Seamus, like a father, as he was for so many young writers, so many young people. He was a great teacher as well. Is now behind all of us. And in some ways, the poem, I've loved it for personal reasons, because like so many young men, my father to this day was a huge and was and is a huge influence in my life. But it's also in a larger Irish context. There are two Yeats plays that deal with fathers killing their sons, and of course, Playboy of the Western World of Sing also deals with the incredible violence wreaked upon their boys very often by fathers in that tradition. And what strikes me is that Seamus did something else. He basically healed that, the rupture of generations. In over and over and over and over again, he did that. He did it in the way he venerated his predecessors, Paddy Kavanagh, Robert Frost, Joyce, Yeats in particular. There was none of the begrudgery that so often afflicts Irish culture in Seamus. It was constantly celebrating other people, finding the best of them.
Now, a number of years ago, Seamus Heaney made an album with a rather famous musician. The musician was Liam O'Flynn, known for his many years with Planxty. It's called The Poet and the Piper, and there's some very interesting selections here where Seamus reads a poem of his own, of course, and in some cases it's followed by an appropriate piece of music by the piper, Mr. Liam O'Flynn. One of those in particular we're going to start off the next little segment with, St. Kevin and the Blackbird. What's the background of that?
Oh, St. Kevin and the Blackbird. It's actually, Seamus devoted several paragraphs to that, actually, in the address he gave on receiving the Nobel Prize, and he told the tale, the fable of it. It deals with, it's based on a fable, a 6th century fable about St. Kevin, who founded the monastic settlement of Glendalough in the 6th century, standing wrapped in prayer with his arms stretched out in a cross-like position, one palm out the window, and a little blackbird lands in the palm. And he's so wrapped in almost a trance state of rapture and prayer that he stays there for weeks as the little bird lays its eggs and then nurses the fledglings until they're strong enough to go out and take wing and fly. Anyway, let's just listen to that poem, because the second half of it, I'll talk a little bit about that. We did an interview with him in Glendalough, where he literally stuck his hand out the window, imitating St. Kevin in the cell.
Okay.
It's used now in the Celtic Christmas concert in the
DVD,
the film that we've done with it. But that, I'll talk a bit more about it.
St. Kevin and the Blackbird. And then there was St. Kevin and the Blackbird. The saint is kneeling, arm stretched out, inside his cell. But the cell is narrow, so one turned-up palm is out the window, stiff as a crossbeam, when a blackbird lands and lays in it and settles down to nest. Kevin feels the warm eggs, the small breast, the tucked neat head and claws, and finding himself linked into the network of eternal life, is moved to pity. Now he must hold his hand like a branch out in the sun and rain for weeks, until the young are hatched and fledged and flown. And since the whole thing's imagined anyhow, imagine being Kevin. Which is he? Self-forgetful or in agony all the time, from the neck on out down through his hurting forearms? Are his fingers sleeping? Does he still feel his knees? Or has the shut-eyed blank of under-earth crept up through him? Is there distance in his head? Alone and mirrored clear in love's deep river, to labour and not to seek reward, he prays. A prayer his body makes entirely, for he has forgotten self, forgotten bird, and on the river bank, forgotten the river's name.
Well, as I was saying, mischievously, playfully, there was that aspect of Seamus that made him, a truly lovable human being. He got into the cell, stuck his palm out the window, and then started chatting about it. He said, how long would it take for a bird to hatch fledglings? You know, how long would it have to stay there? Weeks, I suppose. You know, could have happened. The end of it, the end of the poem, the last lines of the poem, where he's really questioning, you know, what is going on in Kevin's mind in that trance state, and then taking that instance, that almost psychological factor, and transforming it into almost a mystical utterance, alone and mirrored clear in love's deep river. He prays a prayer his body makes entirely, for he has forgotten self, forgotten bird, and on the river's bank, forgotten the river's name. Well, the river is love. And I said to him, and forgotten the river's name, meaning that it's not a place, it's not a property, it's not something you can label. It's boundless. So I said, it's funny, I said to Seamus, I said, is that, in your mind, in any sense, is that a political poem? And he said, well, he said, if you want to put that kind of rating on it, you're well to choose it yourself. He wouldn't commit himself. He loathed, he actually really loathed the ways in which he had been, people had forced upon him the role of being a political writer in ways that he didn't want to. Mm-hmm. He talked about that. He said, I don't send out encyclicals from the Minister of Truth. He said, that's not the work of a poet.
But there was a time in his career when he kind of had to take on that role because...
Absolutely.
When he chose to take on that role, when he was included in the Oxford, was it, Book of British Verse?
Yeah.
And he took exception to that in verse and eloquently.
Indeed, yeah. The lines, be advised, my passport's green. No glass of ours was raised to toast the Queen. I wonder who the ours is interesting. It is not no glass of mine. Mm. That would have been too egoistic. But I wonder, is he speaking as some ways I like to think no glass of ours, our family. But it's a larger sense of family. Mm. And yet, what, 2-3 years ago, when the Queen actually visited Ireland, that historic visit to Ireland, mm-hmm. where she laid a wreath, of course, in the Garden mm-hmm. of Remembrance, I mean, stunning historical moment, mm-hmm. seated at her side at that banquet in Dublin Castle was none other than Seamus Heaney. Again, is a tribute to an Irish tradition, in a way, the honoring of a great, mm-hmm. I mean... It was in the courts of ancient Ireland. The bard, mm-hmm. if you will, sat at the right hand of the queen, mm-hmm. of the king. It was the highest mm-hmm. highest role in the society.
Well, I guess it was different times.
But I think I was in the Flowing Tide, which is a pub diagonally opposite to the Abbey Theatre, mm-hmm. one afternoon, and it was known that Seamus Heaney had been awarded the Nobel Prize, and they couldn't find him. He was on a vacation in the Greek island somewhere. And then the pub suddenly quieted, and everybody rushed up to watch the television set. And what it was Seamus. They had tracked Seamus down. They sent a government plane to bring him back home. There was a red carpet on the tarmac, and there was the Prime Minister of Ireland and the President of Ireland to greet him. Now, I thought, my God, you know, for all the crap associated with, the Celtic Tiger and the demise of the Celtic Tiger and, the guys with the big shoulders running the country and you know, the wretchedness of the bankers and everything else that has destroyed so much, one felt, of the culture. Now, this is, here was a tribute, not just by the government itself, government officials, but by ordinary people in a pub. I thought, that was a phenomenal statement. And I felt, again, to come back to that New York Times article which I brought with me, just in a way, I was talking this afternoon to a guy at the Decatur Festival who happened to be the literary critic for Time magazine. And he said, that is an incredible tribute on the part of letters, American letters. Which is unprecedented.
Well, he had taught at Harvard, hadn't he?
He was
well known in the U.S., academic
totally.
Circles
as a
teacher.
Mentor. He was at Emory just last March.
Very, very, very impressive.
1,200 people showed up. It was tickets. You couldn't get into the place.
Right, you could hear a pin drop.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, at that reading at Emory, he read something that I think we're going to move on to, and that was The Yellow Bittern.
That's right, yeah. He read, the whole reading for me had an elegiac quality. The man, of course, had suffered a stroke and had never really completely physically recovered, and one sensed that he had aged considerably and... there was an elegiac quality. It was like a valedictory, especially as he left the podium and went upstage and bowed three times, stopped and bowed three times in almost a faltering kind of way. But he opened it up with a wonderful line. He said, he looked out to the audience, and I think he caught the eyes of one or two people, and he said, as Yeats said, friendship is my only home, and I'm clearly at home. Beautiful feeling. But The Yellow Bittern was wonderful. He read a number of Gaelic translations from Irish, which he had turned to in his latterly career. And he made a few comical remarks about the source of the poem, which is, of course, of a yellow bittern, which is found on the ice, having died trying to pluck a hole with its beak so as to get water. And it's a metaphor for the poet who, as he explained, was a drunk. But he was a poet, and he too would die in pursuit of the inspiration that drink would give him in certain ways.
Here we go. This is The Yellow Bittern, read for us by the late Seamus Heaney.
An bunan bui, le cahal bui magilagona. A wunan bui, she moliendo li, is the crawa shintia, the resh the grin. Yellow Bittern, there you are now. Skin and bone on the frozen shore. It wasn't hunger, but thirst for a mouthful that left you foundered and me heart sore. What odds is it now about Troy's destruction with you and the flagstones upside down, who never injured or hurt a creature and preferred bog water to any wine? Bittern, bittern, your end was awful, your perished skull there on the road, you that would call me every morning with your gargler song as you guzzled mud. And that's what's ahead of your brother Cahill. You know what they say about me and the stuff. But they've got it wrong, and the truth is simple. A drop would have saved that croaker's life. I am saddened, bittern, and broken-hearted to find you on scrags and the rushy tufts, and the big rats scampering down the rat paths to wake your carcass and have their fun. If you could have got word to me in time, bird, that you were in trouble and craved a sup, I'd have struck the fetters of those loch waters and have wet your thrapple with the blow I struck. Your common birds do not concern me, the blackbird say, or the thrush or crane, but the yellow bittern, my heartsome namesake, with my looks and locks, he's the one I mourn. Constantly he was drinking, drinking, and by all accounts I've a name for it too. But every drop I get, I'll sink it, for fear I might get my end of the truth. The woman I love says to give it up now, or else I'll go to an early grave. But I say no, and keep resisting, for taking drink's what prolongs your days. You saw for yourselves a while ago what happened the bird when its throat went dry. So, my friends and neighbours, let it flow. You'll be stood no rounds in eternity.
Bittern there, performed first in Irish and in English by Seamus Heaney, and then on the pipes by Liam O'Flynn. It's interesting because that title is actually also associated with Liam Clancy. It's
Oh, really?
It's a title that...
The Yellow Bittern.
The Yellow Bittern, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Let's ask the big question. He got this incredible coverage in not just the New York Times, but all over, and the coverage in Ireland, the saturation of
Ireland.
I was
told of a front cover article on him in Le Monde. Which is, you know, the French Irish Times.
Right. Do you think in a couple of hundred years' time he'll be remembered as one of the great 20th century poets?
I have no right to make that kind of comment. I think the body of work will be remembered. I think that as long as Irish culture is of any significance in the world, he will be viewed as one of the seminal embodiments of virtually every aspect of Irish culture back to the beginnings of time onto, you know, the Troubles of the North to the postmodernist world that left so much of that seemingly behind. And there's a staggering body of work, unbelievable perseverance, a stylist, a master of language. You know, I had Well, I'd have to tell a story again about that, but I was struck the first time I spent any time with him. Most of us search to coin phrases. You know, we try to something, and there's a, you know, there's an image that we're looking for at the end of the sentence over and over and over and over again. He came up with the phrase, and you just were dazzled by the mind, you know.
And yet he wasn't exclusively an Irish poet. I mean, his appeal was international, and in his later years, he also translated Middle English.
Exactly, absolutely. Beowulf, his translation of Beowulf.
For that alone, he'd be quite well known.
A bestseller, yeah. Mm-hmm. His criticism is stunning. He is one of the major, some people, I've heard Dennis Donahue, actually, who's one of the major literary critics of the day, say that Seamus will actually be remembered more for his criticism than he will be his poetry. Hmm. Which is possibly a backhanded compliment. Mm-hmm. I think it's too. Look, I don't have that kind of historical judgment, frankly, to make such a statement on his behalf. Without any question, he's an icon of this age,
and it would be hard to name somebody of that stature in the last 60 or 70 years in Ireland.
No one.
Right.
No one.
I mean, since Yeats,
obviously. Yeats is the only one in that league. Absolutely.
We have Aisling Gyal lined up.
Ah, that happens to be one of my favorite. It's an unusual one. It's a translation of an 18th century Aisling. The Aisling is a very peculiarly Irish poetic tradition created in the 18th century by some of the disenfranchised poets of the, if you will, the Fila class that had been driven into the peasantry. And it essentially represents a longing for a recovery of the fullness of Irish culture, which in fact Seamus represents. And there's a scenario or storyline that is almost inevitable in the poem. A young man is wandering by a lonely woods, and he encounters a radiantly beautiful woman, very often with ringlets cascading down to her ankles. And she seems to be utterly bereft. He inquires as to who she is, and she won't tell him her name. But she says that she's in search of her one true love. How will one know that's the lover? Well, she's fleeing the pursuits of an unwanted lover. And she'll know that this person would be her true lover because he will be willing to sacrifice his life for her sake. That, of course, that figure is Ireland. The names would have been Roisin Dhu for the dark-haired Rose Granuelle, the Sean Van Vaught, many names for her. An Irish-speaking audience would know. You hear these songs translated into English, and you'd say, wow, it's an incredibly beautiful love song. And many of them did have gorgeous airs. We're going to hear the air, an Aisling air, following this one. But the Irish, native Irish speakers would, of course, know the double meaning, and it would be the lover would be Ireland. Incredibly powerful. And I find it fascinating. Just listen to the rhythm and the way he invests. Seamus invests himself in the meaning of that poem as it goes on, especially from a rhythmical standpoint towards the end of it. It's really an enraptured kind of delivery of that poem.
So we're going to hear Seamus Heaney reading Aisling Gyal, and it's going to be followed by a musical interlude from his sidekick on this album, Liam O'Flynn on the Uilleann Pipes. Enjoy.
Gila na gila, le heag an orahala. Gila na gila, the honic or slee in oignet. Brightening brightness, alone on the road, she appears. Crystal and sparkle of blue and green eyes. Sweetness of sweetness in her unembittered young voice, and a high colour dawning behind the pearl of her face. Ringlets and ringlets, a curl in every tress of her fair hair trailing and brushing the dew on the grass, and a gem from her birthplace far in the high universe, out glittering glass and gracing the groove of her breasts. News that was secret she whispered to soothe her aloneness, news of one due to return and reclaim his true place. News of the ruin of those who had cast him in darkness. News that was awesome, too awesome to utter in verse. My head got lighter and lighter, but still I approached her, enthralled by her thraldom, helplessly held and bewildered, choking and calling Christ's name. Then she fled in a shimmer to Lochra Fort, where only the glamoured can enter. I hurtled and hurled myself, madly following after, over caches and marshes and mosses and treacherous moors, and arrived at that stronghold, unsure about how I had got there, that earthwork of earth the orders of magic once reared. A gang of thick louts were shouting loud insults and jeering, and a curly-haired coven in fits of sniggers and sneers. Next thing I was taken and cruelly shackled in fetters, as the breasts of the maiden were groped by a thick-witted boor. I tried then, as hard as I could, to make her hear truth. How wrong she was to be linked to that Lazarus swine, when the pride of the pure Scottish stock, a prince of the blood, was ardent and eager to wed her and make her his bride. When she heard me, she started to weep, but pride was the cause of those tears that came wetting her cheeks and shone in her eyes. Then she sent me a guard to guide me out of the fortress, who'd appeared to me, lone on the road, a brightening brightness. Calamity, shock, collapse, heartbreak and grief. To think of her sweetness, her beauty, her mildness, her life, defiled at the hands of a hornmaster sprung from riff-raff, and no hope of redress till the lions ride back on the wave.
Thank you.
we started off there with the poem The Lammerd, Gilla na Gilla, and then the instrumental called Aisling Gael. Seamus Heaney's greatest hit. I think Digging is the one that he just had to do at every show because everybody loved it. And it's actually the very first poem in the very first collection, the first collection published in 1966, Death of a Naturalist. When you look at the photograph of him now on the cover, he looks so young and yet very identifiable.
Absolutely.
So, Digging, a man of the soil.
A man of the soil who's in the poem we heard earlier, Follower, but with a significant twist on it. He's paying honour to his father and also in the poem his grandfather. And again, it's the meticulousness of their craft which he's honouring, the craft of farming, of digging. But then he switches it over and lays claim to the ardour and to the discipline of the craft that he will follow as a poet. He too will dig. As he said actually in the op-ed article in Saturday's New York Times by Francis X. Klein, who talked about actually drinking with him, and him speaking of the theme that he was pursuing at that time, and that is the silence before words. The vocalization of ideas and feelings that most of us wish to speak, wish to utter, but don't make that commitment. Don't dig deep enough. He's speaking that is his mission. He wants to give voice to the unuttered. In a way, in this poem, he's giving voice to his father and grandfather and saying that I too will dig deep for meaning.
We're going to listen to Seamus Heaney now reading one last poem, Digging. Removal from his home to the Donnybrook Church in Dublin took place today, and funeral mass is tomorrow morning at Donnybrook in Dublin, and then the long drive to Ballyhea Cemetery in County Derry, where somebody else will be doing the digging.
Brilliant.
Death of a Naturalist. Digging. Between my finger and my thumb, the squat pen rests, snug as a gun. Under my window, a clean rasping sound when the spade sinks into gravelly ground. My father digging. I look down till his straining rump among the flower beds bends low, comes up 20 years away, stooping in rhythm through potato drills where he was digging. The coarse boot nestled on the lug. The shaft against the inside knee was levered firmly. He rooted out tall tops, buried the bright edge deep to scatter new potatoes that we picked, loving their cool hardness in our hands. By God, the old man could handle a spade, just like his old man. My grandfather cut more turf in a day than any other man on Toner's Bog. Once I carried him milk in a bottle, corked sloppily with paper. He straightened up to drink it, then fell to right away, nicking and slicing neatly, heaving sods over his shoulder, going down and down for the good turf. Digging. The cold smell of potato mould, the squelch and slap of soggy peat, the curt cuts of an edge through living roots awaken in my head. But I've no spade to follow men like them. Between my finger and my thumb, the squat pen rests. I'll dig with it.
Another translation, appropriate for the occasion. He delivered this at the Emory reading. It's by Colum Kill, one of the three great saints of early Ireland, who was from Derry. And it's a little poem that's appropriate for the moment tomorrow. Derry, I cherish ever. It is calm, it is clear. Crowds of white angels on their rounds at every corner.
A man may drink and not be drunk. A man may fight and not be slain. and perhaps be welcome back again. But as it has so ordered been, what is once past can't be recalled. So fill to me the parting glass, good night and joy be with you all. Oh, if I had money enough to spend, I'd spend it in good company, and for all the harm that I have done, I hope it's pardoned I will be. But as it has so ordered been, what if once past can't be recalled. So fill to me the parting glass, good night and joy be with you all. Oh, of all the friends that e'er I've they're sorry for my going away. And of all the sweethearts that ever I've had, they'd wish me one more day to stay. But as it has so ordered been, what is once past can't be recalled. So fill to me the parting glass, good night and joy.
The Parting Glass there, as performed by Sarah McQuaid, with a little help from Niamh Parsons. And a special thanks to our friend Professor Jim Flannery of Emory University for coming down and sharing his passion and his knowledge and his wisdom in connection with the Seamus Heaney segment. It is the Labour Day Blues Barbecue coming up tomorrow. Big WRFG event. We hope to see lots of you there.
WRFG 89.3 FM presents the 28th Annual Labor Day Blues Barbecue, Monday, September 2nd at the Park Tavern, featuring live performances by the Chris Duarte Group, the Casanovas, Sweet Betty with the Chicago Joe Jones Band, 2013 International Blues Challenge winner, Little G Weevil, and this year's Blues Barbecue honorees, the Mighty Breeze Kings. The Park Tavern is located at the corner of 10th Street and Monroe Drive, overlooking beautiful Piedmont Park. Tickets are $15 advance, $20 at the door. Kids 12 and under are free. Advance tickets can be purchased at WRFG.org. Barbecue will be available for purchase from Fat Matt's Rib Shack. The 28th Annual Labor Day Blues Barbecue, Monday, September 2nd. We'll see you there.
Doodle-doodle-doodle-doo, I'll tell you something awfully true. Wouldn't I hate you, Tally, the new if it was me for the union? Margaret Thatcher was doing fine, closing down the mills and mines. What could make her change her mind if it wasn't for the union? Doodle-doodle-doodle-doo, I'll tell you something awfully true. Wouldn't I hate you, Tally, the new if it was me for the union? And I had a boss in Aberdeen, the nicest fella that ever was seen. He must have thought me hell of a green before I joined the union. Toodle-doodle-doodle-doo, I'll tell you something, I'll be true. Wouldn't I hear you tell you the new if it was me for the union? And I had a boss named Allardyce, he was really hell of a nice. Except for the way he loaded the dice before I joined the union. The bosses, they were doing fine, little children working down the mine. They'd have them on the assembly lines if it wasn't for the union. Toodle-doodle-doodle-doo, I'll tell you something, I'll be true. Wouldn't I hear you tell you the new if it was me for the union? A pal of mine has bought a car, a second-hand Jaguar. He wouldn't have travelled half as far if it wasn't for his union. Toodle-doodle-doodle-doo, I'll tell you something, I'll be true. Wouldn't I hear you tell you the new if it was me for the union? So men and women all agree it's time to rise up off your knee and raise the banner of unity forward with the union. Toodle-doodle-doodle-doo, I'll tell you something, I'll be true. Wouldn't I hear you tell you the new if it was me for the union?
Where, oh, where is our James Connolly? Where, oh, where is that gallant man? He's gone to organize the union that working men and they might yet be free. Then who will lead the van? Then who will lead the van? Who but our James Connolly, the hero of the working man? They carried him up to the jail. They carried him up to the jail, and they shot him down on a bright May morning, and quickly laid him in his gore. Who mourns the death of this man? Who mourns the death of this great man? Bury me down in yon green garden with union men on every side. And they buried him down in yon green garden with union men on every side. And they swore they would form a mighty weapon that James Connolly's name could be filled with pride. Where, oh, where is our James Connolly? Where, oh, where is that gallant man? He's gone to organize the union that working men, they might yet be free.
Seemed timely to play a few songs there in honour of the unions. That's from a Scottish album called The Centenary of the Scottish Trade Union Council, If It Was Not For the Union. And we heard that very song sung by the man who wrote it, Hamish Imlach, followed up with Christy Moore and James Connolly. James Connolly, Scottish born, one of the 1916 rebel leaders in Ireland and very much a union man in his time. And interestingly, in Ireland, they just celebrated the centenary of the Great Lockout of 1913. If you're interested in that, you can find out all about it on the WEB. Take care, be good, and we'll talk to you the next time. And thanks to John Kiger, who's doing such a terrific job with the Celtic Show these days. Bye.
You say you don't need the union, son, you can do it all yourself. You will sign the boss's contract and the union can go to hell. You say they'll treat you fair and honest, the bad old days are a closed book. Well, if ye really believe that, son, you're more glaked than you look. Bad old ways, bad old days, one begets the other. The struggles of the past taught the working class we had to stay together. That our unity was our only key to unlock poverty's chains. While divide and rule was the boss's tool, and son, that has nae change. You say the unions are just dinosaurs to your dead past hanging on, and that they served the purpose in their day, but that knew their days long gone. But what it stood for then, we stand for new. Tell me, son, is it out of date? They want a fair day's pay for a fair day's work and food on your children's plate. Bad old ways, bad old days, one begets the other. The struggles of the past taught the working class we had to stick together. That our unity was our only key to unlock poverty's chains. While divide and rule was the boss's tool, and son, that has nae change. Sign your contract, son, if you think you stand to gain. But mind you read the small print first before you write your name. And then you'd better keep your fingers crossed the boss's profits dinna fall. For in 1,000 bloody contracts they won't save you from the dole. Bad old ways, bad old days, one begets the other. Struggles of the past taught the working class we had to stick together. That our unity was our only key to unlock poverty's chains. While divide and rule was the boss's tool, and son, that has nae changed. While divide and rule was the boss's tool, and son, that has nae changed.